Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Truth and Lies, What People Are Really Thinking, by Mark Bowden and Tracy Thompson, narrated by George Newbern. Everything we see is a perspective, not the truth. Falsely attributed to Marcus Aurelius. Introduction. We can all recall examples when our sense of what another person was thinking turned out to be the truth. Equally so, there have been times when we were so sure we were reading another person right, only to discover after the fact how dead wrong we were. Sometimes we learn the hard way that we were purposely lied to, and cannot believe we did not see it for even one moment, until it was too late. Chances are that no matter the case, we were relying to some extent on correctly reading another's body language. We are inundated through news and social media with clickbait, articles, and guides on how to read body language, which attempt to make it quick and easy for us to glance at someone and deduce their most secret thoughts. For example, they've crossed their arms, so obviously they don't like what I'm saying. They pointed their feet elsewhere. Clearly they are more attracted to someone else in the room. They scratched their nose, so they're a no good liar. The problem is that while some of the time our quick read of someone's body language may correctly uncover the truth about what they are thinking, all too often our readings and interpretations prove incorrect in the moment and we get it horribly wrong. On a good day, there is only about a 50-50 chance of being correct. Having said that, people who are truly practiced at the skill of reading and interpreting body language have found that by following tried and trusted processes, they can be far more effective at deducing what people are really thinking. Here's a story from someone whose job it has been in the interest of public safety to always get the reading right, to examine behaviors, make an informed judgment from them, and then test how accurate his judgments are to uncover the truth of the matter. Listen and ask yourself how much you would trust your current body language reading skills in this situation, where stress and the stakes are high in order to catch a murderer. Our colleague and friend Paul Nadeau is a former police detective with 25 years of investigative background, including homicide, and was a trained polygraph examiner. In other words, a professional lie detector. Paul describes the polygraph as an instrument that can detect the slightest physiological changes in someone's body, changes that can occur when someone is anxious, giving a deceitful answer to a clear question. As the polygraph examiner, Paul had to record and analyze the stress shown when answering questions to determine which ones the examinee may have lied about. Paul notes that, of course, individuals who agree to take a polygraph examination may indeed already be in quite an anxious state, particularly if they are being investigated by the police. Someone in Paul's position understands that if a person being questioned is immediately attached to a polygraph, there is every chance of getting a false positive result. They might look like a liar, even when they are not. Before hooking up any suspect to the instrument, I would first take some time to bring the examinee to a calmer state, putting them at ease. But that's not all. I would also be watching every movement made by the examinee, taking mental snapshots of that person's physicality, looking for changes, especially as we move into talking casually about the subject matter under investigation. Paul shared with us one real-life situation, a homicide case where a gang member had been found in a rival gang's territory, stabbed to death, with 3 deep knife wounds to the heart. The theory was that the gang was sending a powerful message, "Do not trespass on our turf, or else." The suspects were any and all of the rival gang's members. Unsurprisingly, each gang member denied committing the murder, and each of them was requested by the police to take a polygraph test. It was Paul's task to interview and give polygraph tests individually to the entire rival gang, any of whom could be the murderer, and all of whom denied any involvement. But then there was rival gang member number 6, whom Paul describes as displaying body language that felt to him cocky and argumentative. His chin was up and pushed out defiantly. He looked down his nose at me with a lopsided snarl. He hated all cops and had no respect for them. Right off the bat, Paul, a veteran of interrogation and lie detection, put the suspect at ease by leaning in and confiding that he, too, felt much the same way about the officers he worked with. This tactic paid off in that the gang member warmed to him and they got to making small talk. Once they were involved in more relaxed banter, the gang member chatting about his family and girlfriends, Paul noted that he was at this point openly displaying a true smile with no seemingly defensive postures. Paul was effectively establishing an understanding for himself of this individual's most normal behavior in the interview situation when in a relaxed state. The crucial moment of body language interpretation happened when Paul purposely and abruptly shifted the conversation to the topic of the homicide. His eyes left mine, his head turned away, and his arms crossed. Although he answered no to being involved, his verbal answers were inconsistent with what his body language was now broadcasting to me. The more I asked about his involvement, the more he leaned back into his chair, uncomfortably so. This extreme change in body language was all Paul needed to see to have a strong suspicion that this guy was guilty. To test his theory, Paul confronted him with a powerful question. "You didn't intend to kill him. You just wanted to teach him a lesson. Don't come back. Otherwise, I'm sure you would have stabbed him much more than 3 times. Isn't that the way it happened?" The gang member dropped his head into his hands and turned away from Paul, hiding his face. He confessed then and there to the murder and was later convicted in court. For Paul, taking mental snapshots of the behavior as he went through this interrogation, creating moments when a change in body language would stand out, as well as evaluating whether the suspect's words were consistent with the body language he saw, and taking the moment to test his conjecture, made him a human lie detector. He had no need for the polygraph. Of course, this was Paul's job as a law enforcement professional, an essential service in ensuring public safety. Paul was highly skilled and well-practiced in his system for reading body language with accuracy. Wouldn't it be incredibly useful if you could emulate Paul's level of expertise in getting to the truth in your everyday life without going through the detective training and without coming across as an interrogator? For example, what if you understood, as Paul did, the suspect's lopsided snarl, looking down his nose, jutting chin, all his facial expressions that indicate arrogance and contempt, a powerful feeling of being above Paul and the cops? Then if you knew to empathize with the person and find their baseline of relaxed behavior for that situation, to instigate a change in the situation that might reveal a notable change in body language, and to finally test the findings for accuracy, eliciting displays of shame and even guilt, well, that skill would surely prove useful. Instead of you're acting solely on a hunch and going with a knee-jerk reaction to another's body language. Allison Schaefer, a highly respected parenting expert, told us a story that highlights just how important it is to put aside those knee-jerk reactions we can have to nonverbal behavior, to hold off on making wrong and possibly even catastrophic assumptions based on those reactions. Instead, taking the time to investigate situations more thoroughly to get to the truth. One afternoon, as she and her 8-year-old daughter walked their usual route home from school, Zoe started behaving very weird. She suddenly seemed very anxious. This came across for me in her hypervigilance. She was constantly checking out everyone around her. Allison asked her if anything was wrong, and Zoe replied, "No, nothing." But her answer did not ring true to Allison. Over the next few days, Allison saw Zoe repeatedly behaving like this. She also noticed that Zoe was continually stopping to retie her shoelaces. To parents of young children, Allison's first response will be familiar. She took it to be the behavior of a dawdling child. However, Allison made a conscious decision to set aside her initial assumption and also try to keep her annoyance at bay. Instead of saying hurry up, she decided to keep a more open mind and gently investigate what was clearly a change from the norm in her daughter's behavior. Though Zoe kept insisting everything was okay, Allison noticed that with this response, Zoe would quickly look away from her and move on. The evidence was mounting for Allison that her daughter's continued evasive behavior meant something was up. On the next journey to school together, instead of using words to ask if there was a problem, Allison used her own body language to get through to Zoe, just as she was going to crouch down to retie her laces. I interrupted by waving my hand over her chest and tummy, where many people feel their anxiety or tension, wiggled my fingers as I moved my hand in fluttery circles, and asked, "Do you want this feeling to go away?" She immediately looked me right in the eyes and replied, "Yes." I told her I knew someone, a therapist, she could talk to who would help her get those feelings to go away. She was thrilled. We were intrigued by Allison's story, and we asked what was going on. Allison relayed to us the event that had triggered the unusual behavior. The day this all started, as we were on our usual morning walk to school and approaching the lights where we'd cross the street, a woman came out of her house and suddenly fell to the ground in front of us, and then started throwing up. She was holding keys and pointing and saying something in a language I did not understand. I quickly told Zoe to stay put, took the keys, and entered the house she seemed to be pointing at. Once inside, I yelled loudly for help. It turned out that the woman's daughter lived in the house. She came running out with me to help her mom. Once her mom was settled, she sent us on our way, assuring us that everything was okay. While Allison felt very happy to have helped a neighbor and largely forgot about the event, for her young daughter it proved to be extremely traumatic. The woman's being so sick and the feeling of panic at being powerless to help triggered a response of acute anxiety in Zoe. Her changed behavior reflected a new hypervigilance to make sure no one else around her was randomly going to be that ill. And the shoelaces? Retying her shoes was a strategic maneuver to avoid passing that house by delaying until the traffic light turned red, thus forcing them to walk on the opposite side of the street from the house. For us, this story shows some smart thinking by Allison in taking a little extra time to observe the situation, to suspend her own judgment about her daughter's actions. Rather than assuming that Zoe was just dawdling, to be mindful of what was going on in the moment, and then to test her theory that there really was a problem by using her own body language to more powerfully and directly communicate. How easy is it to emulate Allison's decisions and suspend your judgment, to hold off on the easy route of the knee-jerk reaction and remain curious about behaviors you see? How can you learn to be as observant, thoughtful, and objective in your everyday life, to determine whether the behavior of others that has a direct impact on you is meant to have that impact or is just their normal way of being? In other words, how can you get a baseline of behavior for someone that lets you know when something important or extraordinary is happening, so you can reply in a way that is understandable as well as make assumptions that are closer to the truth? When we incorrectly read body language signals, we are likely to make false assumptions about others and what they intend toward us, and as a result, we stand a good chance of disappointment or perhaps experiencing serious consequences. Here's a story about how we put ourselves and our body language out into the world via social media, what signals we send, and how much truth we reveal about ourselves in the way our posts are received. It may very well ring true for you, too. Catherine Naker is a stand-up comedian and comedy writer who works with our organization. One afternoon, she decided that would be the day she would start online dating. Having just changed her look with a cool new haircut, she staged a photo shoot, for which she wore an equally cool-looking dress and held a fake cocktail. The dimmed atmospheric lighting made it look as if she were living it up at an after-party. She even had a photo taken of her on an exercise bike with mocktail in hand, like, "Look at me, I'm crazy," to showcase herself in a 20-something fun girl looking for love and adventure profile. Once done, she filled out the lengthy dating website questionnaire. Questions came up like, "Do you exercise?" "The truth is, I don't, but I didn't want people to think I was lazy. Plus, I just took a picture of myself on an exercise bike in a dress with a cocktail." So let's even that out with saying "sometimes" and other embellishments of the facts. Once she had created the perfect profile showing a version of herself that she felt did basically represent her, though admittedly a version that reflected how she wanted to be seen, she started to make contact with her best suitors. Catherine eventually came across one guy who showed potential. He was the same age and seemed to enjoy parties as much as she did. He had a picture of himself on his profile as the best man at a wedding, his arms around family. His face reflected an easy attitude, a gentle smile, no stressed-out lines of tension. He appeared calm, fun-loving, confident, and outgoing. And his physical description said athletic. I instantly thought, this guy is perfect for me. They agreed to meet. When Catherine saw her date face to face, she was shocked. He did not look like his photo at all. He was much heavier, not only his body, but in his face, too. Also, where his profile picture's gentle smile had been, now sat a forced grimace, showing off a great deal of dental hardware to correct his teeth. But perhaps most disconcerting was that he was at least 3 inches shorter than the 6 feet he listed himself as, which put him several inches shorter than me. He was an okay-looking guy, adds Catherine, but she admits feeling disappointed. It's not that I was so bothered by his shorter, stockier build. It's more that I felt misled, which threw me off. So, we get that he may have misrepresented himself a bit, but how about his character? We asked. Was he a warm, fun guy, the life and soul of the party, just like she thought from his pictures? I had to totally lead the conversation. He was not outgoing at all, way less social than his pictures suggested to me. We asked if any of her predictions about him, based on his profile pictures, were correct. Well, yes, I called that he was into family, right? But I did not quite get how extreme this was. When I could get him to talk during our date, which was rarely, he only talked about his family. He brought them into just about everything. It seemed to be all he was ever thinking about. Slightly weird. And laid back, I got right, too. When he finally got comfortable, he was almost comatose. Toward the end of the date, he was totally slumped, bringing his energy level and his height down even further, all of which made him seem, in real life, totally unconfident. Of course, Catherine realizes the irony of the situation, that despite the best of intentions, neither of them were really what they had advertised on their profiles, that they were both trying to put their best foot forward. However, Catherine, as many of us would, took what he had chosen to include on his profile at face value. The picture of him at the wedding may perhaps have captured the one and only time he was the life and soul of the party. Given that she was not completely truthful either with the snapshots offered on her profile, she admitted that it would be no surprise if he also made incorrect assumptions about her, with nothing to base his expectations on other than that thin slice of life she posted online. Both parties were left disappointed. Misrepresentation is highly likely to happen in these types of situations, and the resulting disappointment, though tangible, is perhaps not such a surprise, given the conundrum of filling out the profile questionnaire. What am I supposed to look like and say? I'm Catherine, looking for the love of my life. Here I am eating pizza in bed. Want a date? Just as in Catherine's story, reading body language both in person and online involves making judgments based on a very thin slice of the data. And this data is often corrupted even before we get our chance to interpret or misinterpret it. It is no wonder, then, that when we don't take the opportunity to critically think in the moment, to observe all the details we can and to test our assumptions, it is easy and likely that we will make terrible errors of judgment based on gut feelings, biases, and innate patterns of thinking about others, feelings that felt and seemed so right at the time that often end up proven incorrect. Reading another's body language and getting it right, and then acting on your interpretation, can surely bring positive consequences. In Paul's case, catching a killer. In Allison's situation, helping someone precious to her. However, the negative consequences of getting it wrong can also have an impact on us, from disappointment that your date wasn't who you thought they'd be, to long-term feelings of loss, sorrow, and regret as a result of not seeing something for what it really was. How did I not see that breakup, job loss, family feud coming? This book will enable you to experience the life-enhancing power that comes with improving your ability to get it right. You will learn about a methodology by which to observe and assign meaning when it comes to body language to get you closer to knowing the truth of a situation. This book offers a clear process for you to follow, teaching skills that will help you address these main questions. How can I make more accurate judgments about what people really think, feel, and intend toward me from their nonverbal communication? How can I test how right I am about my judgments? How can I best govern my actions with the power of this knowledge? This book presents for most a whole new way of thinking about the meaning of body language. You will learn a powerful new process for making and testing assumptions about the meaning of the behavior of others, a process you can take into any and every situation. Use it, and you will gain a powerful understanding around the truth and lies of what people are really thinking. Part 1. Genuine Deceptions. I can read you like a book, all of us. Imagine a world where no one can pull the wool over your eyes. Think about the power you would have if you could detect someone's deepest, innermost thoughts, regardless of what they were saying to you. Living your life where the truth of the matter would always be in plain sight for you. No secret subtext, no covert conversations, nothing ever left unsaid to you. No mystery, no mistakes, no mess. What a wonderful possibility. But isn't this just a fantasy? Every time you click on the link to yet another article that baits you with a promise of teaching you how to discern what is really going on in other people's heads, are you already being lied to? In order to interpret what someone is really thinking by analyzing their body language, there are truths you need to know first. Chapter 1. Body Language Lies. Let's get started by giving you the most all-encompassing and powerful truth about reading body language, while revealing its greatest lie. You cannot read body language. Live nonverbal communication, or body language, is a human communication system, although it is not technically a language in the dictionary sense of the word, like English, Greek, Yoruba, Cree, or Mandarin are. It lacks many of the most important factors common to spoken languages. For one, live nonverbal communication does not lend itself to displacement, language's ability to describe something that is either not here at all or not here right now. We cannot rely on nonverbal communication to clearly describe a concept, such as democracy, nor can we expect nonverbal communication to tell us that the neighbor's cat has been missing since last Tuesday. Additionally, live nonverbal communication does not allow reflexiveness, which is a language's ability to talk about itself. It would be an impossible undertaking to give a nod to your own future nod and for anyone to get that nod about the upcoming nodding. Body language is the communication system that displays behaviors elicited in response to the environment, the experience and interpretation of which can differ from country to country and between cultures and people. These nonverbal behaviors can certainly communicate our feelings and intentions in the moment. And although body language is a physical response to our complex environment, it also has the capability of affecting it. Hang on, you might say. What about all those books and articles and videos and documentaries about reading body language? There are certainly excellent books, experiments, research, scholarly articles, online talks, and documentaries about this topic. However, whether online or off, we have taken to using the analogy that nonverbal communication is like a language in order to make it simpler and within our reach when making decisions about how to respond to others' behaviors. This reductionist approach to the complexities and many nuances within body language can help us understand the motives underlying a vast and complicated array of nonverbal signals. With this approach, sometimes we get it right, and the motives informing some physical actions turn out to be what we deduced. So, the simplicity works when we make the right decisions. But often, this simplistic approach leads us to the wrong conclusions. When we judge another's body language within the framework of believing it really is a language, with consistent rules for translatability, we can really get ourselves into trouble. Our trouble is not transcended in the online world, but exacerbated. Online, where we increasingly spend our time, the multitude of ideas and advice have further chance to become confused. Our engagement in the Internet of Ideas results in our online world mashing up the real-world intricacies of nonverbal meaning into a simple clickbait of instant help and quick fix. In our online world, technology puts in our hands the power to play with the boundaries of what body language is ordinarily capable of. Through photos and video, a moment or sequence of body language signs can exist in myriad future contexts, and so can appear to be capable of displacement. Social media platforms such as Facebook allow us to repost images of ourselves from years before and make new comments on them. Though it may seem that the body language moment is happening now, in fact, it happened hours, days, weeks, or decades previously. These images are always up for interpretation, and so, perhaps not surprisingly, when we post an image of ourselves, we are overwhelmingly keen to control that interpretation, to guide the viewer to see us in the way we would like to be seen. This holds true whether it is our online profile picture, a Snapchat share, our YouTube channel, or our personal or company branding. As viewers, we strive to understand the meaning of the images we see of others, and as creators of our own images, we attempt to control how we are seen in the present and future by the online world at large. So it's no wonder we are attracted to the easy-to-understand, one-size-fits-all, general ideas about the meaning of body language, as this makes it easier and quicker for us to fit ourselves and others into simple classifications and categories. In addition, we may not often distinguish between the meanings of body language we encounter in person versus online. We mix and confuse the two, which can lead us to make some poor judgments. Much of the popular thinking on body language, in keeping with the simplistic concept of translatability, follows an if-this-then-that rationale. It creates a set of absolute rules around gestures, the like of which we've all heard time and time again. For example, their arms are crossed, they are closed to me. He rubbed his nose, he is definitely lying. She crossed her leg toward me, she is so into me. While there are certainly times when those readings and interpretations prove to be true, what is generally overlooked is the impact of the essential factor of context, the actual situation in which the communication occurs. That is, how does context frame the particular nonverbal actions we witness and therefore influence our interpretation of what someone may be thinking? Let's look more closely at the example of the body language gesture and its widely accepted popular translation. Crossed arms equals the person is closed to you. We hear this rule and we think it makes sense. Crossing arms creates a barrier, thereby closing off the body in a defensive posture, intentionally or unconsciously, blocking us off and closing us out. For the most part, we've been happy to run with the easy-to-understand assumption of crossed arms, meaning a person is closed to us. It is easy to see how this simple if-this-then-that idea gained momentum and became mainstream folklore, and ultimately authoritative fact and tacit truth. The jewel left in the dust is any mention of the context in which this line of interpretation may or may not be accurate. Context is critical when interpreting body language. Going back to our example, people cross their arms for a multitude of context-specific reasons other than being close to us personally or to our ideas. Perhaps they're in a cold environment and crossing their arms as a barrier to the cold. Or it's mid-afternoon and they're tired, so they're holding their arms high and tense to keep themselves alert. Maybe they're on their own at a singles bar, feeling vulnerable and therefore giving themselves a self-soothing hug. Or they could be in an important work meeting, concentrating by closing down activity in the hands and arms to direct energy and attention to thinking. So while they may be trying to remain in control and they may be blocking unwanted stimuli, and they may look closed, just maybe, our point here, they may not actually be closed or blocking us or our idea at that moment. We all tend to interpret situations in terms of our own frame of reference as an expression of our egocentric perspective. In the words of Aaron T. Beck, regarded as the founder of cognitive behavioral therapy, with added stress or when we perceive a threat in our situation, as happens constantly as we negotiate our day-to-day lives, our self-centered thinking goes into overdrive. And out of the multiple
sample complete. Ready to continue?